All right, we're finally winding down on Jeremiah. I think this is number 8. I think I forgot to change the number. I think another week or two, and then we'll finish Jeremiah, and then move on to Ezekiel. So we're finally winding down on our Old Testament Bible characters. What is it, 5 years now or four? Yeah, it'll be 5 years in December since we started this class. But we could actually call it Old Testament Survey, I guess, because we've covered quite a bit of ground in that period of time. All right, this evening we're going to be looking at the fall of Jerusalem. Remember that Jeremiah started his preaching as a young man many, many years earlier, and now we're in the 10th year of Zedekiah. Zedekiah only reigns 11 years, so Zedekiah is now in his last year. So let's go ahead and just look at that first second verse, where it says that the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the remainder of the elders who were carried away captive, the letter was sent by the hand of Elasa, and then I'm going to skip over to whom Zedekiah sent, king of Judah, sent to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar, and this is where Jeremiah says, how many years? 70 years. And what's going to happen after the 70 years? Okay. Well, no, after the 70 years, look at that last line on that second verse. I will visit you in what? Which is what? Okay, you're going to come back. And there's a reason that I'm saying this. Now, remember, how many years did I say Zedekiah reigned? See how long we can remember these things, okay? 11 years. And so this is in the very beginning of his reign. So 10 years ago, Jeremiah has already prophesied that the children of Israel are going to return. But as we're going to see in the next event, he's not real convinced of it. He is deeply concerned and maybe even a little bit discouraged over the fact that the siege has come. People are dying. People are starving. Remember what God said they'd be doing to their children? They're eating their children. They're eating their family members. This is a very brutal time, and if you were a prophet during that kind of a time, how would you feel? Maybe like here, if our nation begins to crumble and terrible things start to happen, are we going to be happy about that? No, we're going to be very discouraged, because much as we hate to say it, a lot of our self-esteem and a lot of our feelings of comfort are really based not so much on the scriptures, but on what? Our prosperity, our peace, if we get sick, we have medical care. When we retire, we're looking forward to the money there. We're looking forward to peace. And if that gets taken away and we don't get any of that, are we going to be happy? So you'd like to say, oh no, I'm a Christian and this isn't going to bother me a bit, but I don't know if we'd really be honest if we said that. And Jeremiah is a classic example of this. Jeremiah is told to buy a field. And so he goes out and buys the field. God starts out in that first verse there, number 7, right in the middle of the page. Your uncle will come to you and tell you to buy the field, which is in Anathoth. Now remember, that's where he came from. That's where he was born. And the right of redemption is yours to buy it. I think we remember that if a child, if a man dies, he doesn't have any young men in his family, where does his land go? Remember, they got their land by lot. Where does the land go if he doesn't have any children? Well, it goes to his near kinsmen, right? And this is what happened, remember, with Ruth. Ruth, her husband died, her mother-in-law's husband died, the brother died, they come back, there's no men left in the family. So who does it go to? Who does Ruth marry?
Boaz.
So Boaz is the near kinsman. Now, actually, remember, there was one that was nearer than him, but he didn't want to marry Ruth. So Boaz got it. Well, that's the situation here. God is telling Jeremiah to buy this field, and as soon as he finishes, the uncle comes, and everything that God said came to pass. So it says, I knew that this was the word of the Lord, so I bought the field. And then he tells Baruch, remember Baruch, his secretary or his helper, he tells him in that next verse, beginning verse 13, take these deeds, put them in earthen vessels that they may last many days. For the Lord has said, houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this land. So has Jeremiah been told? Yeah, and he's giving those words to Baruch. But let's see what happens next. I want somebody to read the beginning of this prayer as one of the most comprehensive hallowing. You remember when Jesus said, I want you to pray like this in Matthew chapter 6? And what's the first thing he said? Our Father who art in heaven,
hallowed be your name.
Hallowed be your name. And we've talked about this several times through the course of preaching and classes, that that's not a cliche. It's not just a word that you say, hallowed be your name, although I think sometimes we do that without really giving much thought to the hallowing. But the word hallowed actually means what?
Holy.
Okay, holy, sanctified, set apart. So let's look at how Jeremiah does this. Let's see. Cameron, you want to read that for us? Jeremiah 32, 16 through 20.
Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and your outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you. You show loving kindness to thousands and repay the iniquity of the fathers into the bosom of their children after them. The great, the mighty God, whose name is the Lord of hosts. You are great in counsel and mighty in works, for your eyes are open to all the ways of the sons of man, to give everyone according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. You have set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt to this day, and in Israel and among other men, and you have made yourself a name as it is at this day.
Okay, and I kind of cut it off because it actually goes on for three or four more sentences. But he starts his prayer, and I don't know how long this took. Probably, 30, 40, 50 seconds to go over that. Most of us, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, and then we jump right into our prayer. But he takes some time here, and he extols God, and he praises God, and he sets his name apart, and he expresses to God the things that have impressed him and that he wants to praise him for. But then he says this at the bottom of page 32. Behold, or look at the siege mounts. The city has been given into the hand of the Chaldeans. What you have spoken has happened there. You see it. You have said to me, O Lord God, buy the field for money and take witnesses. Take, yet this city has been given into the hand of the Chaldeans. Now, what's he saying here? Okay, does this make sense to him? The city is about to be destroyed. Yes, God is great and powerful, but the city is about to be destroyed, and you want me to buy a field? And so his expression here is one of maybe it's not doubt. You remember what Hezekiah said when God said it's not going to happen in your day, it's going to happen in the days of your children and grandchildren? What did he say?
It's good.
Yeah, good. It's not going to happen in my day. Well, Jeremiah's bought this field. Is he going to get this field? No, so it's kind of the opposite. So either he has some doubt or he's just really struggling with the fact that you're having me buy this field, but I'm never going to get it. And why are you doing this? And so let's go ahead and turn over to the next page where God says the very thing that Jeremiah just said at the beginning of his prayer. I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? Now, who else did he say that to? Is anything too hard for Jehovah?
Moses.
Okay, was it Moses or was it Abraham? I think, wasn't it Abraham when he told him he was going to have a son? And he said, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And God said, is anything too hard for Jehovah? So, repeat it again. And this time, God is the one saying it. And he says in verse 28, I give this city into the hands of Chaldeans, and he shall take it. So, yeah, you're right about that part, Jeremiah. But then look at the next section. God promises forgiveness and restoration. He says, I will gather them out of all the countries where I've driven them in my anger. Now, keep in mind, these people have gone into the Assyrian captivity, they have gone into Babylonian captivity, they have been taken from their land and driven out into many different countries. And from a human perspective, what are the chances they're ever going to come back? I mean, the whole nation's destroyed, the temple's destroyed. How often do people get to come back in a situation like that? But what they're forgetting is, what did God promise to Abraham? I'm going to give you what? This land. And through your seed, all nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Well, has that happened yet? Hasn't happened yet. Can God lie?
No.
So God, and actually, didn't Hebrews 6 say, not only did he promise, but what else did he do?
Swore by himself.
He swore by his own name, and then it goes on to say, and there's one other thing. So there's two things. He made a promise, and he swore with an oath. Then it says it's impossible for what? For God to lie. So we have strong assurance. But at this time, of course, Jeremiah did not. Jeremiah was deeply concerned about the fact that he had to buy some property when the land was going to be destroyed. Now, why do you think God did this? Did God want him to have the land? Was that the problem? Or was he trying to show Jeremiah? He was testing Jeremiah and hoping that Jeremiah would pass the test. He didn't fail it miserably, but he struggled with it. And again, I think we can put ourselves into his feelings, because there's times when we struggle with the same things. I mean, a lot of people have been asking the question after these last two hurricanes, why didn't God stop it? Why did God allow all the people, and especially his people, to go through these terrible situations? And, of course, what's the answer?
Time and chance. Well,
time and chance. If you get enough hurricanes and they hit enough places, are they going to come in and hit other people? Well, yeah, that's going to happen. So to say, I know God didn't stop this, that God allowed it to happen, well, yeah, but that's something that's factored into the gospel. Are we promising the gospel physical blessings for our service? We promise long life, health, wealth, prosperity, peace. Look at the Christians in the first century. Did they get any of that? No, most of them really had some serious problems. Anyway, God says, I did destroy them in verse 26 through 28, but I'm going to gather them out of all the countries where I've driven them in my anger. Now, you remember in Isaiah, not only does he get the people bringing them back to Jerusalem, but then he talks about a second gathering. When is the second gathering going to occur? Okay, in the book of Acts. The book of Acts is the second gathering. When Jesus was getting ready to ascend to heaven, he said, first in Jerusalem, then where? Judea and Samaria, and then the remotest parts of the earth. And as Paul said in Romans chapter 1, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So God was gathering them again. So the ultimate fulfillment of this promise was after the crucifixion of Christ. But God does promise, and he fulfills it, although when we get to the book of Ezra, it's going to be a dismal amount of people that come back. It's just in the thousands, just maybe 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people out of the multitude. You remember God promised Abraham, your seed will be like what? Stars of the heavens, or what about that sand? The grains of sand, that's how many you're going to have. But how many come back after the Chaldean or the Babylonian and Assyrian captivity? Just a small handful. Brian?
Yeah, and in this particular area, I mean, we're in chapter 32, but as you know, chapter 31 is where he makes the promise of the new covenant and talks there about drawing all men to himself. And so
right, on. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we have both of these promises here. Then finally, in verse 43, fields will be bought in this land of which you say it is desolate. Men will buy fields for money and sign deeds and seal them and take witnesses. So Jeremiah, your great-great-grandchildren are going to be really happy that you did this. Of course, did Jeremiah have any children? Remember what God told him in the beginning? You shall not marry, because all the people in this land are going to die terrible deaths. So I don't want you to marry, and I don't want you to have children. All right. Any thoughts on this particular section, again, Jeremiah is just being tested, and his faith is being bolstered, and God is once again trying to push him into spiritual growth and development. All right, how many of us have heard of the Rechabites? Okay, we got one. I'm sure many of you will remember this story, but the reason I put it in here is it's just a fascinating insight into how God works, because it's not their submission to God's law that causes God to uphold them as a great example to the people. It's actually something quite different from that. And the things that the Father commanded them to do were not against the law of Moses. So it starts out, and I just want to make sure we know, who are the Rechabites? Well, in that first box, we start out under the illustration of the Rechabites. It says, Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. So we're going to start with Moses' father-in-law, and we're going to start with the Midianites. Okay? So then in the next verse, the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. So now Hobab, the son of Reuel, is also called the Kenite. All right? And then in the next verse, Judges 4, it says, Heber, the Kenite, of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. Then finally, in 1 Chronicles 2:55, it says, these were the Kenites who came from Hamath, the father of the house of Rechab. All right, so these Rechabites, are they children of Israel? No. The Midianites, where'd they come from?
Midian? No, I'm just
kidding. Okay, yeah, they came from Midian. That's exactly right. That's probably about as far as we can go, because right now I don't even remember where they came from. I think they came from Lot, but I can't remember for sure. It might have been one of Abraham's offspring through one of his other children. I can't really remember, but they were related to the children of Israel. If anybody can figure that out, let me know. Although I guess we could just look it up in a concordance. Okay, but anyway, we do know that Hobab was Moses' father-in-law, and when Moses was sent out of Egypt by Pharaoh, he came to this particular man and married one of his seven daughters, and this individual is then called the Kenite, again, not of the children of Israel. And then we find out that he is the father of the Rechabites. So the Rechabites are not children of Israel. Let's start that first. Okay. Now, beginning in verse 2, toward the bottom of page 2, it says, go to the house of the Rechabites and give them wine to drink. Now, is this alcoholic wine? Would God be tempting them to drink and sin? No, God doesn't tempt people to sin. This is just regular wine. Verse 5, I sat before the sons of the house of Rechabites, bowls full of wine and cups, and I said to them, drink wine. But they said, we will drink no wine, for Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall drink no wine, you nor your sons forever. Now, we don't know how long this was. It obviously was generations ago. And so God is impressed with this, and he wants the children of Israel to be impressed with this. Look at verse 8. We have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he charged us. Now, verse 13, what does God tell Jeremiah to do? Go talk to the children of Judah and tell them about the Rechabites. Verse 14, the words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, which he commanded his sons not to drink wine, are performed. For to this day they drink none. They obey their father's commandment. But although I have spoken to you, rising up and speaking, you did not obey me. Surely the sons of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, have performed the commandments of their father, but this people has not obeyed me. Now, does this sound kind of familiar? Remember what Jesus said to the children of his generation regarding the Queen of Sheba and the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah? They're going to rise up in judgment and what?
Because they were condemned.
And condemn it. Now, does that give you an interesting insight into the judgment day? The children of Israel are going to say, how could we have known? But Jesus said, if the works that had been done here had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented in dust and ashes. But they weren't done there. But the children of Sodom and Gomorrah will rise up in the judgment day and condemned. Now, whether that will literally happen or whether God will just use them, I think the judgment day is going to be a fascinating insight. Everybody's going to have excuses, right? I mean, you got all these years either in torment or in paradise, be thinking about what you've done. And when you go before the judgment day, you're going to be able to explain to God. Well, God's going to be able to take people. You know, I've often thought about it in our generation. There are going to be people in our generation who are going to say, the world was so wicked and it was so difficult with the Bible. How could we possibly obey God? And God's going to be able to point to us. What's he going to be able to say? These people did it. Could be done. I grew up, a lot of you grew up in a home where there was no teaching. There was no guidance into what the truth is. We found the truth. Can it be done? Sure. Yeah, it can be done. So is their argument going to hold any water? No, because all God's going to have to do is go to Romans chapter 1 and say that what excuse do they have? Could they see what we see? The everlasting power and divinity of God and the things that are made? Why didn't they see it? Well, they didn't want to see it. And the gospel is not difficult to understand. As we pointed out, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, God did put some difficulties in there for us to wrestle with so they'll humble us, but it's not hard to find. So God is using the Rechabites to show the children of Israel that you could have done better. These people prove that it can be done, but you didn't do it. They did it for their father. I sent prophets to you. I had miracles for you. I had given you my law. I had shown you. I had punished you. And yet, they didn't listen. Now, one of the interesting points that is made in verse 18, that I really want you to think about this. Jeremiah said to the house of the Rechabites, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father. And then look at the last words. Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not lack a man to stand before me forever. So as a result of their relationship with their father and their obedience to their father, what is God saying about their relationship to him? I mean, what does it mean that they shall not lack a man? What does it mean, I guess I'd say, to stand before God? Okay, be approved.
There's somebody there.
Excuse me?
There would always be someone there,
and what would they be doing? I mean, if you're standing before God, are you standing before him as a sinner? No, this is a servant of God. So their integrity had so impressed God, and I suspect, I mean, obviously, is it just because of their relationship with their father? Don't we have people today who are very honorable to their mother and father, yet they never obey God? Are they standing before God? No. No, this has to do as much with their relationship with God. Which, is there something in the scriptures about children obey your parents in the Lord? Or honor your father and mother, for this is the first commandment with promise? In other words, this is part of the law of God. And God also told them, you shall diligently teach these things to your children. So there's clearly a disconnect here between what the children of Israel were doing and what the Rechabites were doing. So this is I look at it as a parable or as an illustration, and it's just one of those critical things that I think we all need to keep in mind, because we all like to make excuses. We all like to say, well, the way I was raised and this difficulty and people just don't know how tough I've had it. And so we start rationalizing, and pretty soon we're not working as hard as we should work. And yet there's some, you know, look at the Olympic contenders. Are they willing to make sacrifices? Do they sit back and say, oh, it's so hard to do this? No, they push beyond it. And that's exactly what Peter said we're supposed to do in 2 Peter 1. They add to your faith virtue and then knowledge and then self-control and perseverance. So when we start shrinking back and making excuses and rationalizations, we need to remember these people and other people who show that this is important, that we can do what others are doing in our relationship with God. I remember a poem once. I can't remember now what it was about, but it was something along the lines of, if the gospel was really true, then I would die for it, and I would make sacrifice. And he just started listing off a litany of things that other people do for lesser goals than Christianity. And he just went on and on and on. And I thought, wow, this is kind of an interesting poem. I'm sure you could find it on the internet. But it illustrates here what God's trying to do with these Rechabites, that you need to look at people in the world and understand that if they can make these difficult sacrifices for what they want, then what should we do in our faith with God? We ought to be making more sacrifices than they are. That's why, as we saw in 2 Timothy last week, the soldier on service, the hard-working farmer, and the athlete are all illustrations of what Christians should be doing. And if they work harder at what they can do than we do, what are we going to be leaving ourselves open to on the judgment day? See, a rebuke. All right, let's move on at the bottom of page 2. Jeremiah is arrested again. This time it's kind of an interesting set of providence tying back to the property that was brought. So the army of the Chaldeans left the siege of Jerusalem for fear of Pharaoh's army. So they went out to combat Pharaoh's army. They beat him and they came back quickly. But during this time of reprieve, verse 12, Jeremiah went out of Jerusalem to go to the land of Benjamin to claim his property there among the people. So he was going to go back to Anathoth and he was going to take a look at the property. Well, when he got to the gate of Benjamin, let's turn over to page 3 now, the guard that was there said, "You are defecting to the Chaldeans. So you are a traitor. You are betraying your country." Jeremiah says, "False. That's not true. I'm not doing that." But they beat him. They put him in prison. They accused him falsely. In verse 15 there, the princes were angry with Jeremiah. They struck him, put him in prison in the house of Jonathan, the scribe. When Jeremiah had been there many days, Zedekiah the king sent and took him out. And then he pleaded with him in verse 20 there, "Let my petition be accepted before you. Do not make me return to the house of Jonathan the scribe, lest I die there." So Jeremiah wasn't being treated well. There wasn't a lot of food. He wasn't being fed. So verse 21, Zedekiah commanded they should commit Jeremiah to the court of the prison. He didn't release him. He should have, but he didn't release him. But he at least gave them a daily piece of bread until all the bread for the city was gone. So this is another price that Jeremiah had to pay for his relationship with God. Now, you remember at the very beginning of the book, what did God tell him? "I'm going to make your brow brass, and I'm going to fortify you. And can they beat you? Can they prevail over you?" No, they're not going to prevail. But how does it look right now? He's in prison, maybe die there. Does it look like they might prevail? But we'll see at the end of class, although I don't think we're going to make it tonight. But we'll see at the end of the class, he did prevail. All the children of Israel were killed, and Nebuchadnezzar said to Jeremiah, "You can go free, and you can go wherever you want." So who won the battle? See, Jeremiah did. They were all dead. Now, God makes this demand of them in Jeremiah 38, 1 through 4, and that is, if you stay in this city, you die. If you surrender to the Chaldeans, I'll give you your life. So it's up to you. Well, again, in verse 4, the princes said to the king, "Let this man be put to death. He weakens the hands of the men of war who remain in this city." So they're not happy with Jeremiah, but this is God's word. Then Jeremiah is saved by an Ethiopian eunuch. Okay, so this is the first Ethiopian eunuch that we read about. They took Jeremiah, cast him in the dungeon, and this is a worse dungeon because as soon as he gets in there, what happens to his feet? They sink down into the muck or into the mire or into the mud. And it isn't just up to his ankles, because when they try to get him out, they need to put rags on his under his armpits to get him out of there. So how deep would you say? Would it be tough to get him out if it was up to his ankles? Probably not. How about to his knees? Maybe. But maybe a little higher than that. So maybe up to his waist. He's stuck. He's stuck in that mud. Well, verse 7, Ebal-Melech, the Ethiopian, one of the eunuchs. So this again is an Ethiopian eunuch. And he goes to the king and he says, these men have done evil in all that they have done to Jeremiah the prophet, and he's likely to die. So the king in verse 10, take 30 men with you and lift Jeremiah out of the dungeon. So he gets some rags and he tells him in verse 12, put these old clothes and rags under your armpits, under the rope. And Jeremiah did so, and they pulled him up with ropes and lifted him out of the dungeon. And then God promises again, this man is not a Jew, but because he's done this for Jeremiah, what does God promise? I will deliver you, verse 17. You shall not be given into the hand of the men you're afraid of. Verse 18, I will surely deliver you. You will not fall by the sword. Your life shall be as a prize to you because you have put your trust in me. So you see how extensive God's providence is? I mean, God doesn't have to physically intervene in all these situations. I mean, look at Nebuchadnezzar. Did God force Nebuchadnezzar to tell Jeremiah, you go wherever you want to go, you're free? No, it was the circumstances. Jeremiah's in there preaching, if you'll surrender, so how does Nebuchadnezzar see him? This guy's on our side. He's trying to get the people to surrender. So was that God's providence? Did God have to allow him to preach that? No, but this is one of the things that God does. Now, in this particular case, we really don't know how he does it, but he says, I will surely deliver you, and you shall not fall by the sword. Now, everybody else is falling by the sword. How's God going to keep him? Well, he can do. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Charles?
Yeah, it just kind of reminded me of the story in Acts when Paul was in prison and how he was delivered also, too. Remember all of those people? I think it was about 40 people that was going to assassinate him.
Yeah.
And then they took him out and they got him to a safe.
Yeah, and he saved him with his own, what was it, nephew.
Yeah.
Which you would have never thought that anybody from Paul's family would want to help Paul. They all kind of turned against him. But yeah, that's how God works. He finds the individual. He sets up the situation. I mean, I think the Ethiopian eunuch, the second Ethiopian eunuch, is a classic example of that. He tells Philip to leave one place. The Ethiopian leaves another place. And hundreds of, well, you know, at least 40 miles, 50 miles apart from each other, and yet they get to the exact same place at the exact same time. Could you do that? Could you calculate that out and figure in all the delays and all the situations that might arise and get those two people on that road at exactly the same moment where Philip has to run to catch up with him? So, again, this is God's providence. It just works in amazing ways. All right, Jeremiah's final words to Zedekiah are unheeded. And let's start on page 4. He pleads with him. He says, if you will surrender to Nebuchadnezzar, the city won't be burned, it won't be broken down, the temple will remain, and you won't die. God will spare you. And Zedekiah says, I'm too afraid of the nobles. I'm afraid of what they might do to me, the ones who have already defected to the Chaldeans. And Jeremiah says, that's not going to happen. God is going to protect you, but please surrender. If you surrender now, none of the terrible things. I mean, this is God's mercy. He's so angry. He's threatened to destroy Jerusalem. But if this one king will do one thing, what does God say? I'm going to relent. I'm going to relent of every evil thing if you just do this one thing. But Zedekiah wouldn't do it. He would not do it. Look at the last thing Jeremiah said in verse 20. They shall not deliver you. Please obey the voice of the Lord which I speak to you, so it shall be well with you and your soul shall live. Well, fear kept him. You know, here's another thing. You say, well, God, I'm just afraid, so I know you'll understand and you'll forgive me even though I'm not doing your will. How's that going to work? See, it's not going to work. We must obey God rather than men. Even the Apostle Peter realized fear doesn't enter into this. All right, last paragraph there, or excuse me, under the fall of Jerusalem, in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the city was penetrated. Nebuchadnezzar finally broke down the walls, and here all these brave guys run away. They try to get away, they leave the city to be destroyed, and they try to get away. But in verse 5, the Chaldean army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah. They captured him, brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, where he pronounced judgment. Verse 6, the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. The king of Babylon also killed all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze fetters to carry him off to Babylon. Now, what would that be like to see your children killed before you and then you're blinded? So what's the last thing you ever saw? All your children being put to death. I mean, it's just a horrible thing. Ken?
Wasn't he the king that said to Jeremiah and I think Isaiah, you guys got to get together and make it straight because I can't be carried to Babylon. And he had some way of taking their prophecies against each other, and so he didn't listen to them. And they both came true right there. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You must be thinking of a different prophet because Isaiah died hundreds of years before Jeremiah. Yeah, no, he died before the Assyrian captivity. He died, 7, I don't know. Anyway, it was a couple hundred years before that event. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that event. Let's do some research this week. Maybe we can find what you're referring to. So verse 8, they burned the king's house, the houses of the people with fire, and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. They also took all the articles of the temple, and they destroyed the temple. And so then the very last portion is that Nebuchadnezzar gives Jeremiah his freedom. So again, the point that I wanted to make, and that's why I put these two verses in here, at the very beginning of his prophecy, God said to him, I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar and bronze walls against the whole land. Verse 19, they will fight against you, but they will not prevail against you. Now, is being thrown in prison prevailing against you? It says they will not prevail against you, so we might think so, but what does God think? Can we suffer for him? Then they're not prevailing? If we don't cave in, have they prevailed? Absolutely not. However, in verse 19, they will fight against you, but they will not prevail. Then the next verse is after he falls away the first time, after he says, I'm not going to preach anymore, I'm leaving. And so God says, in the previous verse, I didn't put it in here, if you return to me, I'll return to you. And if you take out the precious from the vial, that's the first verse here, verse 19, you shall be as my mouth. I will make you to this people a fortified bronze wall, and they will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. For I am with you to save you and deliver you. I will deliver you from the hand of the wicked, and I will redeem you from the grip of the terrible. Now, I'm sure Jeremiah wondered about this when he was sunk in the mire, or when he was in prison starving to death. But now here at the last, in Jeremiah 39, verses 11 through 14, Nebuchadnezzar gave charge concerning Jeremiah. Take him, look after him, do him no harm, but do just as he says to you. So now all the children of Israel are dead, the children of Judah are dead, are in captivity, and what's Jeremiah get?
Freedom.
He's got his total freedom. And he dwelt among the people. Now, it doesn't end well. I mean, we're going to talk about this next week. Even though he had his freedom, the children of Israel kidnap him and take him to Egypt. And we don't hear any more about him. We aren't exactly sure what happened after that. So that'll be our class next week. We'll probably finish up the book of Jeremiah next week and prepare to move into the book of Ezekiel. All right. Appreciate your time. I hope the class was edifying to you. And again, we'll pick up next week in Ezekiel.